You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I was joined by Dr. Charles Adale. Unlike some of the other interviews I've done for this series, this interview focuses very heavily on the military side of the conflict. At the end of the day, the Spanish Civil War was a military conflict, and the military side of the story does deserve some attention. One of the interesting items that we discussed was how a seemingly small decision, how military units were organized within the Republican Army, would have consequences that caused issues for the Republican political leaders far outside of the military context and far away from the front lines. I hope you enjoyed this interview, because I know I enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Adale. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm here with Dr. Charles Adale, the author of many works, but most relevant to our discussion today, The Spanish Civil War, A Military History. Dr. Adale, how's it going today?
Well, about as well as it ever goes in 2020. I had a text from one of my students, an ex-student the other day, doing a PhD, and said he felt that doing a PhD was like being in an existential wasteland. To that, I could only respond that for all of us, whatever we're doing, 2020 is an existential wasteland. I'm looking forward to 2021.
Yes, so am I. Absolutely.
Yes. But anyway, onwards and upwards. At least I have history to occupy myself with.
Mm-hmm. So we're here today to talk about the Spanish Civil War. And so when we think about the Spanish Civil War, I think there is a tendency, anytime we're dealing with a conflict, to put hard dates on things, especially the beginning of conflicts. When I read about the beginning of the Civil War, it seems like chaos. Did people around Spain know that a civil war had started, on July 18th, when it did?
Well, nobody, to start off with, nobody was really expecting a civil war as such. What the conspirators were hoping for would be a takeover across Spain, a united turnout by all the garrisons of Spain and, of course, the Spanish colonies in Morocco and so forth. And it would just be a takeover. It would be a coup. And it would be, all right, there might be some trouble from socialists, communists and the like, but they'd be put down within a matter of days. And I don't think the socialists and communists and anarchists and so forth ever really thought in terms of a civil war. What they thought would happen would be that the people would rise up en masse. There'd be general strikes, Spain would be paralyzed, and the coup would collapse. I don't think anybody expected the 2.5 years of civil war that followed. So in that sense, civil war came as a surprise. And meanwhile, there was a tremendous amount of confusion. The plot didn't take place all at once. I mean, the sort of risings. I mean, the first one is, it begins, and in fact, the evening of July the 16th, in Morocco, and then spreads to the rest of the Moroccan garrisons on the 17th. And then you've got risings in mainland Spain on the 18th and the 19th. So things are going off all over the place all the time. All sorts of rumors were flying around. The government was frantically broadcasting disinformation. For days and days, the government kept saying, you know, there's nothing happening, there's nothing happening. Oh, well, there is something happening, but it's only a little local difficulty. And of course, what they were doing was a perfectly legitimate tactic and sensible tactic. What they were frantically trying to do was to persuade would-be rebels that the coup was a failure, that there was no coup to join. And funnily enough, I mean, I remember vividly the night of the 23rd of February, 1981, which is the last attempted coup in Spain's history. And I can remember, I was in London as it happens, but I remember tuning into Radio Cadena, which is one of the leading Spanish radio stations, independent stations. And it was quite surreal. It was very, very much like 1936 in that you had this sort of light Europop music tinkling away, and then every so often the announcer would say, you know, everything is quiet, everything is calm, you know, there's no need to panic, everybody should stay in their houses. And of course, what they were scared of was, just as the government was in 1936, was that the left would pour onto the streets and provoke a lot of army officers who were in fact neutral into joining the uprising. So there was a huge amount of confusion.
So when we're talking about these garrisons sort of joining in the revolt, I guess you might call it, how did they find out what was happening? Were officers that were in charge of these garrisons, you know, did they get information from military sources and then, you know, do whatever they felt they needed to do?
Well, the conspiracy was the work of national organization. Basically, what happens is that from fairly early on in the Republic, there had been a number of officers who were determined to overthrow the Republic by force. But when you say a number, it's only a very small number, actually. Most officers were neutral. And there were, in fact, they might privately have monarchical ideals, but they were prepared to work with the Republic. And there were, in fact, quite a number of Republican officers. So you have this little group, and it organizes itself in something called the Unión Militar Española, the Spanish Military Union. And by the end of 1935, yes, it's got adherents in many places. Its numbers have been growing, but it's still by no means a majority of officers. Then you have the elections of February 1936. That produces a conspiracy among the generals, many of whom had not been members of the Spanish Military Union. They obviously get in touch with rebel subordinates. And so, if you like, the germ of rebellion spreads ever outwards amongst Spain's garrisons, you know, military units, police units, the Navy, the Air Force, to a much more limited extent, and of course the Moroccan garrisons.
So you mentioned the Moroccan garrisons, and sort of at the beginning of this, the conspirators have a problem. They need to get troops from Africa into Spain. Do you think there's a real possibility of Republican forces sort of preventing these troops from getting into Spain? I know that there's like the much discussed assistance of German and Italian transport aircraft involved at this point. Was there a chance that this could have ended early on at this stage by the conspirators not being able to get people from Africa to Spain?
Yes, it's entirely possible. The Republicans had massive naval superiority, particularly in the area around the Straits of Gibraltar. The Spanish Navy basically has two main depots, if you like, two main ports. One is La Coruña, which is, or rather to be precise, El Farol, which is next door to it, which is right up in the northwest of Spain. And the other is Cartagena, which is down in the southeast of Spain. Now, in Cartagena, you had the submarines, the destroyer flotilla, and most of the cruisers. Up in the northwest, you essentially only had just one of the old battleships that had been left to Spain, and a couple of new heavy cruisers which had just coming up, were just coming on stream. And what happens is the Republican cruisers and destroyers sally out, or at least some of them do. They blockade the straits. But then a combination of heavy cruisers coming down from the north, or one in particular, and fear of the air, that means they turn around and scuttle back to port. Now, had the Republican fleet shown more aggression, shown more staying power, it's difficult to say what would have happened, but it's possible that the rising could have been bottled up. Even with air power, the number of the German and Italian air power, the number of troops who could be shipped across by air, you know, was not very great. And the majority actually end up going by sea, but they're able to go by sea because air power, the judicious application of air power, has terrified the Republican fleet and made it decide to stay in port, basically.
And so it sounds like the majority of the Spanish Navy sort of remained loyal to the Republic, though.
It depends what you mean by the Navy. The officer corps was overwhelmingly nationalist, unlike the Air Force. The Air Force was overwhelmingly Republican. But the Navy was overwhelmingly nationalist. But what happens is that the situation on a warship in the aftermath of the coup was very different from the situation in most towns and cities. If you imagine warships of the period, very cramped, confined conditions, very little need to display any tactical competence. It's, you know, it's all about how many men can you get together to rush a stairway. Mm-hmm. You know, and you don't need very many because the stairways are very narrow. You know, equally, I suppose you don't need very many men to block them. But what happens is that the officers rise in revolt, and in the destroyers and the flotillas, destroyers and the light cruisers and the submarines and so forth, the crews revolt against their officers and either kill their officers or take them prisoner and take over the ships. Now, with the heavy vessels up in the northwest, at the orders of the government, they put out to sea and head for Morocco, show a force and also blockade the straits. Whilst they're at sea, their officers revolt. The crews immediately counter-revolt, turn on the officers, take over the ships, turn the ships round and go back to El Farol and find that they've sailed into a nationalist stronghold.
Perfect.
I mean, you know, let's go back to confusion. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they're overwhelmed and the ships are just taken over. So, you know, very good example of a very, very messy story. And, you know, frankly, a very bloody one. The little mercy was shown to rebel officers on the one hand, and certainly little mercy was shown to the crewmen who took over the battleships and cruisers and so forth up in El Farol and fell into nationalist hands.
When looking at sort of the fighting that develops as the two sides sort of, as it becomes a legitimate civil war and sort of both sides' militaries are increasing, one of the early focal points is Madrid. Franco, I know, supported an attack on the city, but some others sort of on his side did not. Do you think that the failure of Franco and his forces to take Madrid was kind of a decisive turning point in the next and what extended maybe the Civil War?
As soon as you get into sort of speculative history, obviously you're in the realm of believe it or not, speculation.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it was always assumed in the Nationalist High Command that Madrid was one of the places where they might have a problem. There were conspiratorial elements in the city, and it was expected that they would rise and revolt. It was also expected that they wouldn't be strong enough to take over the city. And so the idea was that they would hole up in their barracks or whatever and wait for relief columns that would converge on Madrid from all points of the compass. Now, as it happens, the garrisons in Madrid were suppressed very, very quickly, and there was nobody to relieve. But even so, the basic idea remained in play. I mean, the capital is an important place. Let's go and get it. So almost the only offensive action which the Nationalists engage in, there are a couple of small campaigns up in the north, which aren't unimportant, but the major effort as far as the Nationalists are concerned is once they've actually joined up their various bits of territory, basically by advancing up the Portuguese frontier, expanding their holdings in Andalusia, yes, Madrid becomes the prime objective, and Franco famously marches on Madrid. This, incidentally, is where you get the origin of the word, of the phrase fifth column, because Franco, I believe it was General Mola who said this, who was, he was actually the chief brains behind a conspiracy, commander in northern Spain, and he said, well, there are four columns of troops marching on Madrid, and there's a fifth column inside the city waiting to take over. So that's where you get the fifth column from. But anyway, so Franco and company march on Madrid. Obviously, send the majority of their striking forces to attack the city. Now, there's an important decision that should be talked about, because I think this is probably more important than the way you originally phrased the question. Franco diverts from the direct road to Madrid. He diverts off to the right, off to the southeast, if you're looking at the map, to go and relieve the garrison, Nationalist garrison, which had been holding out in the centre of the city of Toledo since the beginning of the war. Tremendously photogenic, telegenic situation. Anybody who knows Toledo will instantly recognize the Alcázar. Anybody who knows the city of Toledo knows that it's dominated by this enormous Renaissance castle called the Alcázar. You know, you can see it for miles, sticks up above the whole city, dominates the whole city. The Nationalists had barricaded themselves inside this fortress. Fairly small garrison, only a few hundred men, quite a number of women and children. And they'd been besieged. And Toledo is only a short drive from Madrid. You could get into all sorts of places where you could watch the fighting perfectly safely. So it becomes a focus for the world press. And you know, many, many newsreels are shot there. So it becomes a the whole place becomes symbolic of the contest, and both sides need to win it. Now, Franco diverts from the main road to Madrid to go and relieve the garrison. And there are historians who say that he did this solely to boost his political prestige and to help him in his bid to take over the uprising as its supreme leader. And indeed, to become head of state. Yes, this does happen shortly afterwards, but I don't think there's any real evidence that that was why Franco diverted. Yes, it was useful, but there were perfectly good reasons for doing what he did, perfectly good military reasons. So that's where the diversion was. So he relieved Toledo, loses 2 or 3 days in the process, heads north for Madrid. What I think you're thinking of is some notion that there could be a wide encircling movement rather than a direct attack on the city. Totally impossible. The attacking forces only had about 10,000 men, and you can't surround a city as big as Madrid with 10,000 men. And in fairness to the nationalists, what they did was to employ an, if you like, an indirect approach. Very difficult to express this without a map. But if you can imagine Madrid as an apple hanging on a tree, if you can imagine putting your left hand up to grasp the apple, and you've got your thumb against the bottom of the apple, and your fingers curl around the outside of the apple, the left-hand side of the apple, curl around and pluck it. That's exactly what the nationalists did when it came to attacking Madrid. They used some of their troops to pin down the defenders, launching feint attacks on the south of the city. The bulk of their forces actually marched round through the old Royal Hunting Park, which still occupies a large amount of space on the western side of the city, the western side of the city, marched through that and then curl through across the river up there, and then advanced through the university city on the northwestern side of the city. And from there, they could reach boulevards taking them into the heart of the city centre. So there was quite a lot of subtlety in Franco's approach. It was a very sensible approach. It was the only approach which had any hope of winning. Madrid is a battlefield like any other battlefield. You know, to understand it, you have to walk it, you have to explore it, you have to understand the lie of the land. And frankly, an army coming from due south would have run into terrible problems. First of all, you have to get through a belt of essentially shanty towns, slum housing, light industry. And then there's several miles of that. And then you get to the river. Now, the river that runs through Madrid is not the Thames, let alone the Amazon, or even, dare I say, the Potomac. It's a nondescript little trickle. But where it flows through the city centre, it had been canalised because there was a danger of flash floods in the autumn rains, things like that. So you had this 10 or 15 foot drop to the river. And then on the other side, you had a 10 or 15 foot upslope. And these are vertical. But it's not finished yet. Then you have to fight your way uphill. And it's a 1 in 3 hill. It's incredibly steep up to the top of the bluff on which the bulk of the city sits on, and you have to do that through the streets of the old, well, not medieval city, I suppose Renaissance city. Madrid dates from about the 15th century. Absolutely appalling task, which would have soaked up men like anything. Then Franco only had 10,000 men. And even the militias, the Republican forces facing him were essentially militias who were militarily useless, to be blunt. Even the militias could probably have blunted his attack. As it was, he chose to go through open country around the west of the city. The Custer Campo, the royal hunting park, is basically lightly wooded scrubland. Very easy to move around in. It's not like, you know, hacking your way through a rainforest. But you know, quite a lot of cover. You know, you can move through it without being seen from a distance. Then you come out the other side of that, head down to the river. And at this point, the river isn't canalized. So you've got nice, easy banks down to each side. It's November. The water was low enough to ford. It had been raining quite a lot, but it wasn't particularly difficult to get across. So you could ford the river, and then you've got a nice, fairly easy slope up to the university. University buildings were built on empty steppe land, very little way of vegetation, and the Republicans could try and defend them, but there was no way they could support each other. They weren't joined together by trenches or anything like that. So basically, it was a very, very easy route by comparison. And then when you got to the edge of the built-up area of the city, whereas down at the other end you had all these narrow streets you had to fight through, you had these nice, long, straight boulevards dating from the late 19th century. Think about Haussmann's Paris, which led straight into the heart of the city and would have been very, very difficult to block. So actually, Franco, yes, in a sense, he tries to quote-unquote rush Madrid with such forces as he had on hand, but he doesn't. He does it in the only way that's militarily sensible.
He makes a good choice, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. Franco wasn't a brilliant general. He wasn't a spectacular general. He wasn't a showy but general. Had he, for the sake of argument, been trying to defend Poland in 1939 or France in 1940 or the Soviet Union in 1941, he would have been, you know, one of the many generals who was just completely and totally outclassed. He had no notion of how to fight a mobile war, at least how to fight against armed divisions and everything that come with them. But he was pretty good at the sort of wars he was used to fighting, and he was certainly good enough to take on such forces as the Republic had. And most of the time, in the course of the war, he does pretty sensible things. You know, every move is quite logical. And there are people who say, well, you know, if he had launched a blitzkrieg attack like the Germans and Italians were telling him, well, excuse me, but if you want to do things like that, you have to have not just lots and lots of tanks. And he didn't have lots and lots of tanks. He never gets sent more than about 300, and they've only got machine guns and they've got very light armor. You need not just tanks, you need armored personnel carriers. You need self-help guns. You need cross-country vehicles of all types. You need a level of motorization, level of mechanization which the nationalists never, ever had. And except you know, in those cases where Republican opposition just completely disintegrated, which does happen in eastern Spain temporarily in March 1938, you know, they have to go at a fairly plodding pace and engage in fairly limited operations. Now, yeah, forgive me, you did ask me if the successful Republican defence of Madrid was a turning point in the war. Would the war have come to an end if Franco had taken Madrid? Possibly, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
The Republicans had plenty of militias in the rest of Spain. Madrid was actually a very, very difficult place to defend. In the wake of Franco's advance on Madrid from the south, it was almost completely cut off. It was in this finger of territory surrounded on three sides by the nationalists. Very difficult to supply. Yes, it's possible that the Republic might have suffered such a moral panic that it would have collapsed. But it's also possible that the fall of Madrid might have made things easier for the rest of Spain by shortening the line and by taking away, if you like, the magnet tendency exerted by Madrid. Madrid becomes a sort of symbol of heroic opposition. Madrid becomes, or it is, becomes a, is taken on by the communists as a symbol of their commitment to the struggle. It's the communists who control the arms supply. Almost all of it comes from Russia. Where do the communists want to stick the arms? Well, they're going to be fascinated by Madrid, particularly as they're in a very strong position there politically. Net result is that Madrid sucks in, you know, huge numbers of field guns, anti-aircraft guns, machine guns. It's very heavily fortified. You know, you can walk the fronts today and you can see, you know, large numbers of pillboxes and things like that. Huge amount of effort to limited purpose.
Mm-hmm. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The situation in Madrid, I'm sure, was somewhat confusing at that point. Like, how much did the nationalist forces know about what was happening in Madrid? Did they know for sure that, like, you know, those uprisings had failed early in the conflict and maybe hadn't stuck around?
Oh yeah, they knew perfectly well what was going on.
Okay.
apart from anything else, so that obviously the Republic is well, Republican radio is, and indeed the press is very quick to trumpet, you know, the collapse of the risings in Madrid and anywhere else that the rising failed. There were, I mean, the civilian telephone network was still working to at least a certain extent. And so it was possible for people to, not always, but sometimes, ring each other up. There were a lot of regional radio stations which were, you know, you could at the very least judge that they were Republican or nationalist. And finally, there were indeed plenty of nationalist sympathizers in Madrid, and some of them undoubtedly, you know, were able to take information to Franco. When we talk about a front line in the Spanish Civil War, in some places it does become, and Madrid's one of them, it does become a bit like the Western Front in World War One, you know, with very dense trench lines and pillboxes and barbed wire and all the rest of it. But in much of Spain, the front line wasn't really a front line at all. It was just a series of isolated outposts, you know, sometimes 2 or 3 miles apart, and you could just slip through if you could find somebody to guide you. So there were plenty of people who, you know, who did get out from Madrid across the lines. Not so much when Franco was on the edge of the city, because a battle's going on, but only a few miles to the north of Madrid. Remember I said that Madrid was in this sort of finger of territory? Well, if you went due north, you very quickly bumped into nationalist territory in the mountains north of Madrid. And, you know, they were, if you knew the paths, if you could find a guide, you could get through them. So the nationalists knew pretty much what was going on.
Okay. So skipping ahead a bit here and sort of looking at the conflict as a whole, obviously we know that it ends in defeat of Republican forces. Do you think this is attributable to Republican military mistakes, or did other factors simply shift the balance of power too much against them during the conflict?
Very often when people talk about the Spanish Civil War, the things that they come up with, you know, explain the nationalist victory in the Spanish Civil War. Oh, the Condor Legion, 88 millimeter guns, Hitler and Mussolini poor in resources. And you get the idea, very strong idea, that the nationalists enjoyed massive military superiority. Now, I'm not going to say that the nationalists did not get more aid than the Republicans. They did. But you still have to qualify the aid that they actually got. Now, if you look at Germany in the 1930s, Italy in the 1930s, well, sort of 1936 anyway, were they capable of supporting a major war effort? No. I mean, Italian war industry certainly wasn't up to it, just in general. German war industry might have been, but of course German war industry was building everything it possibly could for the Luftwaffe and the Wehrmacht. A lot of what gets sent to Spain is pretty second-rate stuff. Some of it was First World War material. Some of it was stuff which dated from before the First World War, which was already obsolete in 1914. Yes, the Germans sent 88 millimeter guns. I believe about 90 of them turn up. It, you know, it's not a war-winning force. If you look at the aircraft which is sent, initially, the nationalists, sorry, the Germans and Italians alike, well, they can come up with reasonable bombers, but the fighters that they send are hopelessly inferior to the fighters that turn up on the other side. Until July 1937, or even a bit later, the Republicans have air superiority. If you look at, well, I mean, I've already talked about how a lot of the guns, the field guns and so forth, sent to the Nationalists were pretty old, certainly no better than the ones the Republicans were getting. If you look at rifles, machine guns, you know, we're not talking about the sort of stuff that you see, you know, German soldiers running around with in World War II films. We're not talking about MG42s or MG34s or Schmeisser machine pistols. You're talking about, again, World War I surplus stuff. The German stuff was mostly okay. The Italian stuff mostly wasn't okay, and including actually many of their newer weapons. I mean, I could spend an entire interview talking about Italian machine guns and just how awful they were. So actually, in terms of actual material superiority, yeah, the Nationalists were a bit better off. They didn't get more of everything. They got more of some things. They certainly got more in the way of ammunition. That is certainly true. And so they have more strategic possibilities, perhaps, than the Republicans did. But I always said to my students, the way of looking at it was this, that the Nationalists got 200% out of every single weapon, every single shell, every single tank, every single plane that they were sent. The Republicans invariably only got 50%. Why is this the case? Partly it's a reflection of the chaotic political situation in Republican Spain. You know, too many arms got diverted to secondary fronts for political purposes, and Madrid becomes a secondary front. It basically took up far too much in the way of resources. But also, there is a massive, massive fundamental flaw at the heart of Republican military organization. Very soon, the Republic realizes it needs a regular army. You know, I will make no bones about it. The militias, which emerged from the revolution in 1936, are just useless. You know, it's not a very romantic way of looking at it. But if you deconstruct the situation, that is what they were. They were, at best, playing at soldiers. Well, if you want to fight a war, you have to do something other than playing at soldiers. You have to be a soldier. And the Republicans realize that they need a new army. And most of the political factions in Republican Spain agree with the notion. And it's a notion which is being pushed forward, particularly by the communists. At this point, I suppose we ought to have a long discussion of the communist position. But let me just say this. At this point, throughout, the communists are bitterly opposed to the notion of revolution. Revolution's broken out in Republican Spain as a result of the uprising, and they want no part of it, and they want to put it down. They actually become a conservative force with a small c. So they're all in favour of having a regular army, and anybody who was opposed to the revolution wanted a regular army, because with a regular army, you could put down the revolution. But at the same time, a regular army was what you needed to fight Franco. So far, so good. The trouble was that the Republic from its very inception had over and over again shown itself to be an utterly incompetent regime. If you unpick the details of its agrarian policy, for example, you know, the idea of land reform, it just becomes completely farcical. The hash that they made of it is just laughable. And sure enough, they proceed to make a hash of organizing the new army. Now, forgive me if things get very technical and arcane at this point, but sometimes the significance of things are missed precisely because they are arcane and technical. Many people who have worked on the Spanish Civil War, majority of people who've worked on the Spanish Civil War are not military historians. They're political historians, social historians. Many of them are not interested in war as such. What they're interested in is the interplay of party and faction politics. What they're interested in is the position of women in Republican Spain, position of women in nationalist Spain. What they're interested in is poster art. Yeah, all of these are interesting, fascinating topics, but they don't necessarily get us very far when it comes to understanding the war. So this is where things are going to get very, very gritty. If you're going to form an army, you need to choose an organization. You need to choose the framework round which you're going to build the army. You're going to have to decide on what units you want and how those units relate to each other. And essentially, you're going to have to think about how you build the army's organigram, as it's known. And typically, armies are pyramidal structures in which you have, right at the top, you'll have the German army as such. That might be broken down into army groups. So army group center, for example, on the Eastern Front. Army groups are broken down into armies. Armies are broken down into corps. Corps are broken down into divisions. Divisions are broken down into brigades. Brigades are broken down into regiments. Regiments are broken down into battalions. You have essentially all armies have a pyramidal structure, but they can differ in how they go about that. And the Republicans came up with a totally crazy notion. I mean, a notion that was completely and totally counterproductive. This is the notion of the so-called mixed brigade. Now, a mixed brigade, as its name suggests, is a force of, let us say, about 3,000 men, if it's at full strength, in a ordinary army. Divisions are about 3,000 men. Brigades are about 3,000 men, and then three or four of them make up a division, which will be 9,000, 12,000 men. Okay, that's far, that's good. But in most armies, in normal armies, you only get infantry brigades, or for that matter, armoured brigades. What the Republicans did was to say, okay, these brigades need to operate independently. That means that they all have to have their own artillery batteries. They all have to have their own medical company. They all have to have their own signals company. They all have to have their own supply company. They all have to have their own cavalry squadron so they can carry out reconnaissance. And so what the Republicans come up with is, if you like, the notion of a brigade as a miniature army. Why did they do this? Because they were thinking in terms of the colonial warfare which had been waged in Africa against the Moors. In the colonial wars, and as in most colonial wars, you know, it had been a matter of punitive columns. You sent out a column into the blue, and it went around taking enemy strongholds, burning enemy villages, burning crops. And because it had to operate independently, it had to have all the necessary bits and pieces you need to have a functioning military force. That's okay when brigades operate independently. What became clear very, very quickly was that these units were not going to have to, were not going to be operating independently. They'd be operating as part of divisions. Those divisions would have to be operating as part of corps. Corps would have to be operating as part of armies. But the Republicans get stuck with a system of organisation whereby everything, all their resources, are parcelled out in penny packets. If you have, for the sake of argument, 50 guns, 50 field guns, if you fire them as one group of 50 guns, so you concentrate all the guns in one place, you fire it at one particular area of the enemy lines, or alternatively, you split those 50 guns up into 10 groups of five, spread them out, you fire at lots of targets, fire over a wider area, whatever. You still got 50 guns, but have you got the same weight of fire? No, you don't. You need to concentrate. That means in organization terms, resources like tanks, resources like heavy guns, well, like any guns actually, apart from, you know, very, very light ones like anti-tank guns, they have to be held further up the line. You know, a division will have, for the sake of argument, three infantry brigades and a brigade, and so on. Net result is that the Republicans come up with a system of organization that wastes weapons, wastes firepower. But it's even worse than that. It's not finished yet, because these units are administratively very complicated. They're made up of lots of different types of soldier. That means that each of them needs quite a substantial headquarters to operate successfully. That means that you're going to have a lot of men tied up behind the lines in non-combat roles. nationalist military organization was much more conventional. And that doesn't mean boring. It doesn't mean regressive. It doesn't mean reactionary. It just means more effective. The nationalists consistently get more out of their weaponry, more out of their manpower. And this is an absolute millstone that hangs around the Republic's neck throughout the war, and which they can never escape from.
It's really interesting to when sort of learning about those kind of like almost hidden mistakes, like mistakes that, you know, maybe a lot of people don't know about, or maybe it might even be hard to sort of find information about that. It's interesting to see how that can affect everything else that happens. What you know, could be considered a small mistake of how do you organize these things turns into sort of cascades out into huge problems.
Yeah, you can see it in terms of conscription as well. Because the nationalists were much more savvy in their use of manpower, they actually have to conscript far fewer men than the Republicans do. The Republicans end up having to conscript a far larger number of men for a far smaller military force.
Which I'm sure doesn't help their political situation at all, given the divisions and problems behind the lines.
I mean, because the next thing that needs to be said, and I know that I'm straying into controversial territory here. Many people, and indeed many historians, are fixated on the idea that on the one side in this struggle, you have the heroic Spanish people, and on the other, you have the generals, the bankers, the church, the elites. I'm not saying that model is completely wrong. I mean, you can certainly see the Civil War as a struggle between reaction and progress, even revolution. But what it does presuppose is a Spanish people who are intensely politicized, and a Spanish people who are caught up in socialist fervor. People who are very, very, very strongly politicized. If you deconstruct the situation, you find the situation is completely different. What you have is a veneer of politicization. You have political organizations, socialists, communists, anarchists, who had a fairly solid core group of militants who were pretty prepared to do whatever the party told them to do, and who rushed off the fighting the militias at the beginning of the war. Then you had the next tier of people who were the followers. They joined trade unions because it got them a union card. But they didn't like turning out to meetings, and they're not going to volunteer for the war. And then beyond them, you have another tier, which is people who are, frankly, completely and totally ignorant of politics, and they just plod along on a day-to-day basis. And they've got no interest in joining the militias, and they've got no interest in the political ideologies of the period. put all this together, and you have a situation in which, far from the Republican zone being full of eager young recruits marching off to war, you have a situation where the political leadership is desperately trying to convince the populace to fight, convince them that the struggle is theirs. And frankly, most conscripts on the Republican side, indeed, most conscripts on the nationalist side, were very apathetic, very unwilling to risk their lives, very unwilling to be heroes. So when you have a system of conscription which bites very, very heavily, as the Republican system came to, well, obviously they're not going to feel happy about it.
I think we're at the end of our time today. Thank you for coming to chat with me today. It's been very enlightening.
But thanks, Wesley. Nice to meet with you, and I hope we meet again.